The power of radio. There's nothing like it. Bob Gleason with us as we talk about his new work and Into the Night, Into the Fire, rather, and Into the Fire, Into the Night. Not a bad title either. But we'll be back with them. We'll take calls next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Bob Gleason with us, his book, and Into the Fire. Bob, the rich Saudis that bankrolled 15 out of the 19 hijackers, did they do it because they were afraid? They wanted to get them away from them, or why did they do it?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of different theories on the on why the Saudis bankrolled. We know from the that Senate 9/11 commission that we know that there were two wealthy Saudis that bankrolled at least two of the 9/11 hijackers, and 15 of them were, of course, you know, Saudis. They cut a deal with Al Qaeda and with Bin Laden that if they would practice their terrorism outside of Saudi Arabia and leave the kingdom alone, all those states are terribly afraid of uprisings, revolutions, and if they would practice it in other countries, that they would not only not arrest them, not imprison them, that they would give them money. And the and so there's this tradition, and these people are fantastically well. They have billions of dollars, and they're constantly signing checks to people. And they would send Bin Laden a lot of money. And the also there's a book out on Bin Laden now, the Bin Laden family, and they said that when they weren't members of the royal family, but they did business.
His father, Mohammed Bin Laden, owned that construction company in Saudi Arabia, built most of the cities.
Yep, that's right, and that he dealt with he got most of his contracts, most of his big money came from the Saudi royals, came from the royal family, and the royal family was very eager. They were very impressed, you know, with what Osama was doing, the war in Afghanistan, and that. And they were throwing money at him hand over fist.
Yeah, absolutely. When he turned on us because he wanted us out of their country, mm-hmm. Saudi Arabia, that wasn't going to happen, and we supported him. We supported him when we wanted to get the Soviets out of Afghanistan, and then he turned on us, like so many of them do.
Yeah, well, we bankroll a lot of that stuff. That the when we talk about the Saudis providing seed money to ISIS and Al Qaeda and Bin Laden and all that, where do you think they get the Saudis get their money? You know, we consume 25% of the world's oil,
right.
And a lot of it comes from the United States. One of the reasons that we are so reluctant to take on nuclear power, nuclear terrorism, nuclear proliferation is you really have to go after the nuclear power industry. And we got too many people making money off of it. You know, I want to go back one more time, and I promise I won't bring it up anymore. But I want to go back to Michael Flynn and that group of people trying to sell 40 nuclear power plants to the throughout.
Well, are they succeeding too, by the way? Are they selling them?
No, the thing finally fell apart.
Oh, it did fall apart.
Partly because the it was exposed, and Michael Flynn was forced to resign.
Ah,
he's under
okay.
Investigation now, and so everybody kind of went their separate directions. But when you look at that Flynn's dream of selling 40 nuclear power plants throughout the Mideast, including a bunch of them to Saudi Arabia, that really is. It's beyond stupidity. It's beyond suicidal.
It's pure
psychosis.
Greed.
It's beyond malignant greed. It's genuinely evil. This is evil worthy of the Antichrist, of the Prince of Darkness. This is the evil in Revelation that causes God to finally come down, destroy the earth, and send a third of humanity howling into hell. This is so bad that this it really summarizes, you know, the worst instincts of humankind. This is I'm shocked at the sheer audacity of it, and that the Trump administration would hire this guy and make him a national security advisor. This is you said before we're going into very desperate, dangerous times. We really are.
Oh, no question. Let's go to some calls here for you. We'll pick it up by going east of the Rockies, Pat in Minneapolis, to get us started. Hi, Pat. Go ahead.
I've always wondered what you'd think of the death of Stalin. I've heard a theory, several theories, and maybe Khrushchev killed him. And if he did he grab him with his bare hands and just strangle him, or what do you think?
I actually know a little bit about that, believe it or not. I was friends with the late Adam Ulam, who was one of the great Stalin scholars. He wrote Stalin, the Man in the Era. Stalin was dying of emphysema. He'd been a lifelong, smoker. And he was on his deathbed. And they had Khrushchev, who was there, Molotov, Beria, who was in charge of the NKVD, now the KGB, that and the Stalinist death camps, everything. He was the most dangerous man in the Soviet Union. And Beria was next on Stalin's hit list. Stalin, if he survived, was going to have Beria liquidated. Beria knew this. So Stalin's dying of emphysema. He can't get his breath. And every so often he passes out and appears to die. And he convulses a little bit, seems to die. And all the time, Beria is kissing Stalin's hand, tears flowing, bathing Stalin's hand in tears. And the sobbing, "Oh, I love you so much, Uncle Joe." And then Stalin would seem to die. And then Beria would spit on his hand and smack his hand and go, curse. And then Stalin would wake up, and so Beria would start kissing his hand and sobbing again. Khrushchev used to tell this story with great hilarity. And Stalin finally convulses and dies of emphysema, dies of no more oxygen. So then, but they're all afraid. Molotov, Khrushchev, and these guys, they're all afraid of Beria because he's the most part. He controls a lot of the military, everything. So they have some guys with guns, and they're walking Beria to the courtyard of the Lubyanka, where he's to be executed. They're going to kill him right away. As they're walking through the hallway, somebody shoots him in the back and kills him in the hallway. They did not even want to get. They were so afraid of Beria. They did not even want to get to go to the courtyard. They were afraid the guys that were executing him, they work for Beria, they may turn on him. And there were a lot of rumors that Khrushchev was the guy that shot him. And every so often, a journalist would come up to Khrushchev. Khrushchev was very approachable, extremely interesting guy. And they'd say, Comrade Nikita, were you the one that put the bullet into Beria? And Khrushchev would just laugh. He wouldn't,
Wasn't Beria also a sexual predator?
Oh, yeah. He was
a lowlife.
A molester, everything. Yeah. He was completely, completely horrible. To some extent, Adam Ulam believed that a lot of those guys, that they caused so much human suffering, and that a lot of those top party people, at some point they had to get off on it.
Is that when Khrushchev rose to power after that?
Yeah, Khrushchev was interesting. He was the only guy in the Politburo, the only guy in Stalin's inner circle that could actually do something. He ran the Ukraine, and he ran it 100%. It was a centralized economy, lots of agriculture, coal mines, steel mills, all that. And Khrushchev was 100% in charge of that economy. He was an extremely capable, competent guy. He was the only guy in Stalin's inner circle that could actually do anything. The rest of them were just flunkies and hacks. And one of the reasons that Stalin never had Khrushchev liquidated was he needed one person who could actually do something. Khrushchev built the Moscow subway system.
When Khrushchev finally became the premier and he was here in the United States back in the 60s,
yeah,
he was ticked off because they wouldn't let him go to Disneyland.
Yeah, that's true.
They told him, they says, "We can't guarantee your security there."
Yeah.
And he said, "What do you mean you can't guarantee my the police can't take care of your gangsters?" Unbelievable.
Yeah, that Gorbachev came to the United States and Canada, and he was looking at some farms, and then got up early, and he'd been the Secretary of Agriculture out of Sevastopol in Stavropol, I think, in Russia, and he went to one of the big farms, and it was 5 a.m., and the workers are out there working really hard, and he said to the guy that owned the farm, he said, "How do you get your workers to get up at 5 a.m. and go out and work?" He said, "Well, we pay them." And then the Gorbachev was in shock.
I think Khrushchev liked Kennedy deep down. I think they had a respect for each other.
Well, they had George Kennan had once said about the Russians, and he told this to, he was a great Sovietologist, and he told this to Kennedy. He said, "You never want to paint the Russians into a corner." He said that we were talking before about how dictators have a certain kind of rationality. We don't recognize it because it's extremely amoral, and it's also very self-centered. They are interested in consolidating, expanding their personal power.
That's what they want, and wealth.
And they are extremely rational, and when it comes to their personal power, they do not want to be deposed. And the Stalin Stalin was arguably the worst person in the world. But everything he did, even when he killed 14 million kulaks, it always ended up expanding and consolidating his power. He dies in his sleep at the height of his power.
Yeah,
which is a horrifying thought.
What does that tell
but,
you?
But what Kennan said to Kennedy was, these people, they are rational, and he said that they will. You know that, and that they, if you have a problem with them, a crisis, if you offer them a graceful exit, he said, though, and it's to their advantage, they will take it. He said, you never paint them into a corner. He said, you paint the Russian bear into a corner, and the bear will rise up on his hind legs and come at you. And by the way, the Putin said something. He had to kill rats when he was a little kid, and he used the same image in describing rats.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm like that.
He's one of the world's wealthiest people. Nobody knows that.
He is the world. He's three times wealthier than Bill Gates. He's, by the best estimates, he's worth over $200 billion.
Yeah, he's got a great deal. Who is worse, Hitler or Stalin?
Well, if you look at just pure numbers,
Stalin, despicable.
Stalin killed 60 million of his own people in times of relative peace and prosperity, and if you want to look at the sheer and Stalin was largely responsible for causing World War II. He purged the Red Officer Corps. He killed 80,000 of his top officers, generals, colonels.
80,000?
Yeah, 80,000. He stripped himself naked in front of Hitler, the army. He'd gutted the Red Army. And at which point, in order to do that, he set up the Hitler-Stalin non-aggression pact where they wouldn't attack, they promised not to attack each other. And so then he killed all these officers, and Hitler looked at it and said, this is my chance, And so that I can invade Russia and get rid of Stalin.
Yeah.
And when they divided up Poland, that they had suddenly the border in the middle of Poland. You had Russia on one side and Hitler on the other side. So instead of having Poland, which was a large, strong buffer state in between Hitler and Stalin, suddenly there was nothing in between Hitler and Stalin. So Hitler was really able to blitzkrieg through that border, and with Operation Barbarossa, and invade the Soviet Union. So Stalin, in large part, was responsible for causing World War II. But what the kind of really in almost unimaginable iniquity that was at the heart of Nazism is really unparalleled.
Phil, truck driving in Ohio, you're on the air with us, Phil. Go ahead.
Morning, George. Morning, Bob.
Hi,
How
Phil.
You guys doing?
Everything's good. Thank you.
George, thanks for taking my call. I want to say thanks. You keep us all awake and informed at night, and I truly appreciate that.
Many more nights to come, Philip.
Absolutely.
Yes, God willing. Bob, I was just going to talk to you. I grew up in a little town in southern Ohio called Wakefield, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
Our property actually adjoined a nuclear power plant, mm-hmm. believe it or not.
Yeah.
And it's been decommissioned, so they say, for years, but yeah. I can remember as a kid, I grew up on like a 52-acre farm, and I can remember as a kid going in the back in the woods, playing in the woods and stuff, building tree houses, and they would dig and bury and dig and bury, and I don't know what they was digging, and I don't know what they was burying, but that community has got some, and you can look at yourself, has got some of the highest cancer rates in the entire country. I mean, they done tests on our creek, vinyl chloride, trace, of elements of uranium, all kind of stuff. And I drank and swam in that creek and everything growing up.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't know if you heard anything about that power plant or not.
No, I really don't know. Excuse me one second.
That's right. Get yourself a little glass of water there, Robert.
Yeah, I'm fine.
Okay. All right.
I'm fine.
All right. Now, what about that plant? You don't know much about it.
No, not that particular plant.
I mean, wonder how many nuclear power plants there are all around this planet.
Right? There was approximately 450.
Oh, my God. Because we've got about 120, don't we?
Yeah. Yeah, one of the problems with nuclear waste is, I say we have 100,000 tons of it. There's much, much more worldwide. That for 75 years, we've been trying to figure out what to do with it. As I said, we leave it in pools surrounding 70-some nuclear power plants here in the United States, which is phenomenally dangerous. You blow up the cooling pumps and then everything boils away and suddenly you got fires in those things. Humanity has only come up with one viable solution for getting rid, for storing the nuclear waste. You put it in dry casks. They look like barn silos. They're made of concrete and steel. They're fantastically heavy. They're very hard to ship. You need super powerful cranes and stuff to move it around. Most of the, and you find a hard rock mountain like Yucca Mountain, and you actually dig 70 miles of tunnels under the rock in the mountain, the bedrock under the mountain, and you bore those tunnels. They're 30 feet in diameter. You ship the stuff to that particular mountain, and you put it in there. There are many things wrong with this. Among other things, it takes 100,000 shipments to get it there. Because most it's so heavy, most of it has to be shipped by rail. 25% of the shipments will go through the city of Chicago. So that's perfect ground zero for terrorists. And the but also, once you get it down under the mountain, you put a big heavy steel door on it, you weld the door.
Stored away, but still.
Walk away from it. Problem is that the uranium and plutonium oxides and the compounds, that they disintegrate faster than the actual pure uranium, pure plutonium. So in about 200 years, all that stuff's disintegrated. And what you have is, you have pure plutonium bomb fuel. And so you've created...
locked away in that mountainside.
Mine with these seams, with these veins of pure plutonium bomb fuel. Now, as terrible as this solution is to the storage problem, it's the only solution we've really been able to come up with in 75 years. That if you wanted to make an argument that we are too suicidally stupid to exist as a species, I could make it in two words: nuclear power.
How dangerous is it to launch it into space and send it away?
Oh, it would be, it would be phenomenally expensive.
They
have some of the heaviest stuff.
And if the rocket crashed, we're doomed.
Yeah, no, they've looked at all kinds of possible solutions, and this is actually, it's better than what we have right now, and it's absolutely terrible. Problem is that had we started doing this, shipping it to someplace like Yucca Mountain a long time ago, it might have been manageable to some. It would have been horrible and terrible, but it might have been sort of.
Yeah, but it would have caught up with us eventually.
Yeah,
I
but
think.
Now we got 100,000 tons of it.
Yeah.
There's just too much of it. By the time it would take 30 years to do this, to transport this stuff and bury it under a mountain, it would take 30 years. By the time we were done, we'd have another 100,000.
And how much of it continues to come in every year?
Yes.
And pile up on that?
Yep. Yeah, it comes over three tons a year.
Bob, we're going to come back and wrap things up and take final phone calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, journalist Sally Quinn joins me talking about her work called Finding Magic. By the way, Sally put a hex on a couple people, and they died. We're going to talk with her about that. And we are back with Robert Gleason and his book, And Into the Fire. This book's going to climb up the old charts, Robert. It's well done.
Well, thank you. May I mention my website?
Yes, you may.
www.robertgleasonbooks.com. Gleason is G-L-E-A-S-O-N, like Jackie Gleason. That's www.robertgleasonbooks.com. And the book is, of course, And Into the Fire.
You love doing what you're doing, don't you? I can tell.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I don't think I was. I don't think I was really fit to do anything else. You want to know, which is kind of scary. You want to know the truth.
How's our buddy Tom Doherty doing these days?
He's doing great. We had a big party for Linda Stacy a couple of nights ago, and we were all hanging out.
You tell him hi for me.
I sure will.
Well, let's go back to the calls. Let's go to Joe in San Diego. Hi, Joe.
Oh, God bless you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I have a question for you. I was wondering if you could talk about Fukushima, and I heard that they were cooling the rods that burn up by by dousing it with millions of gallons of water every day, and that the water was leaking into the ocean. And I was wondering if it's still a great danger, and is it producing a dangerous toxin for our oceans? And my second question would be, how close are we to perfecting cold fusion, and would that help with the elimination of
I think the fusion reactors make almost no sense. The one of the problems is that at the heart of a fusion reactor, you have temperatures that are like three times hotter than the surface of the sun. They've never found a vessel that can contain that. For obviously.
I guess not.
but people are insane about, we're getting fantastic use out of these gigantic solar power plants in the Mojave Desert. They're very lucrative. They're making a lot of money. They cost a billion and a half, which is about the price of a gas turbine power plant. South Korea is talking about spending $1 trillion to build a functional fusion power plant. That's insane. Don't they have anything better to do with their money? That this is, and we spent well over $100 billion researching this stuff, all for nothing.
What about water? What about water contamination?
Oh well, because. We mentioned before, Indian Point requires $5 billion of water a day to cool off the spent fuel, the fuel rods, etc. So you have to build these nuclear power plants, such as Fukushima, near either big rivers or large bodies of water. In the case of Fukushima, it's on the ocean, but they also have an aquifer under it. That one of the problems, of course, is and the thing that melted it down was the destruction of the cooling pumps. That's what really melted it down.
When they lost power, right?
And when a couple of those reactors melted down, it's a China syndrome. The stuff just melts into the containment vessel below, and they obviously can't send anybody down. They don't really have any. Equipment. They need all kinds of miniaturized robots to go down and try to deal with it, and they don't have the Japanese don't have the they're no place near creating any kind of miniaturized robots to work on it and do anything. So they're still shooting in the dark. Oh, Fukushima is the gift that will never stop giving. That they 75 years and 100 years from now, the Japanese are still going to be pouring money into that black radioactive hole.
What happens to all this gallons of water, the billions of gallons of water, once it's gone through the cooling system? Is it contaminated?
Oh, yeah.
So what happens to it?
Well, it goes out and eventually ends up in the ocean. They've got radioactive fish. They've told fishermen, not to, if you catch a fish, if it's radioactive, it might kill you. It's going to be going on for a long time. The thing too that's good to remember, that Japan is one gigantic seismic fault. They never should have built any nuclear power plants. Everybody knows that. And we've had Japanese defense ministers who've said the reason we build all these nuclear power plants is once you have a nuclear power plant, you're extremely close to having a nuclear weapons program. Because they've gotten so much spent fuel and they reprocess it, they have more plutonium explosive than any other nation in the world. They're six. Somebody once said they're one wrench turn and two screw twists away from having a nuclear weapon, and that's approximately what it is. And they view their nuclear power plants as a nuclear deterrent against the neighbors in their region.
Does North Korea have a nuke power plant?
Oh yeah, yeah, sure. And they don't have an electrical grid that could handle it, but they do. They do it like that's what all these nations want. They view nuclear power as a Trojan horse inside of which their nuclear weapons program can hide.
Let's go
to. It doesn't make any sense economically. It's too insanely expensive. We mentioned the Sheffield. A nuclear power plant costs $35 billion.
That's crazy.
Expensive machine.
How do you get your money back on that?
Oh, never. And the taxpayers pay for 100% of nuclear power. They pretend that it's somehow private enterprise. It's not private enterprise at all.
Joe in the Queens in New York. Hey, Joseph, go ahead.
Hello, George and Bob. How you doing?
Good, Joe.
How you doing? I tried to call him the other day when you had John Wu on with a military hacking expert. But
yes.
Good question for Bob, too, maybe.
All right.
I'm not sure if this is even possible, but you're always hearing about how a kid will hack into the Defense Department or banking system or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible, my question is, real quick, is it possible to hack into an incoming missile, lock onto it, and reverse the telemetry and turn it around from whence it came from, like not only destroying the launch pads, you know, the incoming missile, but also the launch pads where it came from and any munitions and artillery that are there?
I don't really see how you would do it once it was airborne, but yeah, sure.
They do have that capability, Bobby, because, yeah. You know, like they can take over a highly computerized car that's driving on a freeway, they can hack into that.
Yeah.
They could do the same thing with a guided missile that's taken off. They could probably try to throw it off course.
Yeah, they go up pretty high. I don't I have a one of my authors is a computer scientist, and he says that Raj Pinheiro, and he says that any computer system that we can build, he says, can be hacked.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
There probably is a way to do it.
As we go to final calls here, I also, you and I had briefly emailed, we lost Jerry Purnell a short time ago.
He was a very, very close friend, a great man, wonderful friend. I miss him all the time.
Avid listener to the program. He'd email me a lot, Bob. And if he had a guest on he loved, he told me. If he had a guest on that he didn't like, he told me. And he was one of a kind.
He was a great guy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And what a great author. Lucifer's Hammer. And, I mean, those were books you helped start, though.
Yeah, I did. I edited a lot of his books. I edited a lot of the Niven Purnell collaborations. I'd worked with Larry Niven and Jerry Purnell since 1973, so it was a 45-year friendship.
That's great. Next up, we have Harold in Atlanta, Georgia. Harold, you're on the air with us. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you, George, for being last bastion of free press.
You got
it. Bob, listen, I had an epiphany, and nobody seems to be able to answer this question, but with all the spent fuel and everything, how come somebody it sounds crazy, but how come they can't build a ramp up to a volcanic cauldron which leads straight down to the mantle of the Earth and just dump heat-resistant containers in there and let them sink down and melt into the mantle, all that spent fuel that we're trying to get rid of? And I'll leave it at that.
The idea of the Yucca Mountain, that getting a hard rock mountain and burying it into the bedrock. One of the reasons they want something like that is that you don't want the toxic waste somehow getting into the you don't want it really getting into the water system, into the water table. And also, you know, what happens if the volcano erupts?
And it could.
Yeah, yeah. You really want to put it someplace where it's not going to start seeping and working its way through the soil and that. This stuff is unbelievably toxic. And you never get rid of it. It lasts for 250,000 years.
Yes.
So you got to be very, very, you know, careful that it's not going to you can't really destroy it. You got to contain it somehow. And as I said, that the only it's a terrible solution, but unfortunately, it's the best solution anybody's been able to come up with in 75 years is to put it in under a hard rock mountain in the bedrock. We created the nuclear proliferation movement in 1953 with Atoms for Peace, and Eisenhower nobody's ever really explained it to me. He had this notion that every nation on Earth had an inalienable right to nuclear power, and he claimed it would be too cheap to meter. Well, I'll tell that to the English taxpayers that had to crank out $35 billion for the Sheffield nuclear power plant. That it's fantastically expensive.
Who sold him a bill of goods?
Yeah, and also that, well, Molotov came up when he gave the speech at the UN where he was, we were going to sell nuclear power technology worldwide, that the Molotov came up to John Foster Dulles, who was Eisenhower's Secretary of State, and he explained to him that the nuclear power reactors are a starter kit for nuclear weapons. It's you're going to be proliferating nuclear weapons technology worldwide. And Dulles said to him, there was a guy there that took notes and wrote it all down. And Dulles said, oh, we'll find a way to fix that. And Molotov said, no, you won't. And he said, we've really studied this. I've looked into it. And he said, no, you're not. He said, the technology is almost one and the same. And and we never did find a way to fix it. But we went out and, you know, we not only sold nuclear reactors to, we sold Iran and Pakistan their first nuclear reactors. We sold some reactors to Italy. They turned around and they sold nuclear reactors to the Congo. They sold them to the Congo. Hey, it's clear that we will, you know, that we will do anything for money. We'll sell anybody anything if we can turn a profit on it.
Joe in Knoxville, Tennessee, it's your turn, Joseph. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I was calling about thorium molten salt reactors. One of the troubles, the reason why light water reactors have the problem they do is, one, they're under tremendous pressure. Molten salt is not under, it operates at atmosphere. Also, light water reactors, they use one half of 1% of the fuel that goes in there. Okay. Molten salt, it gets up to high enough temperature, it destroys 90-something% of what's put in. You can actually put radioactive waste in these things. And the radioactive waste that's left is taken care of in like 200-something years, really under 300 years. They did this. They had a reactor in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, by Alvin Weinberg. He was the developer of the nuclear reactor, by the way. And it operated from 65 to 69. And you know how, like a Fukushima, where they couldn't shut it down because it takes days to shut down a light water reactor.
Yeah.
This thing, on Friday, they didn't want to operate it, so they shut it down. And they sent into these tanks. Monday morning, they could crank that jewel right back up. But of course, at the time, they was ready to go to the next project, develop the next step. But no, everybody had to go for breeder reactors, which produced more plutonium. By the way, that's in my opinion why molten salt hadn't gone any farther than it had, because it doesn't, with thorium, it doesn't do well with making weapons.
Yep.
That's a good point. Thank you, Joe. What an audience, huh, Robert?
Yeah.
They are the best.
Yep.
They are the best. Lori in Erie, Pennsylvania. Let's take a couple more quick calls. Go ahead, Lori.
Yeah, this is quick. Good morning. I used to know what the term nuclear winter meant, but I don't remember it. Can anybody explain nuclear winter?
Yeah, if you had nuclear weapons going off worldwide, you had nuclear Armageddon. That creates a lot of, you know, it burns a lot. So I mean, incinerate whole cities. And what happens?
Dust in the air.
Yeah, they call it particulates, and it's the soot and the particles go up, and they block the sunlight, and so you get a cooling effect. Now that lasts for a few years. However, after the particulates fall down, and this happens, by the way, in the great mass extinction events, that when the KT asteroid hit 60 million years ago, it incinerated the planet, and among other things, and so you had something resembling winter, but then when the particulates dropped off, the greenhouse gases, they form a blanket around the top of the atmosphere, and the heat is trapped. And then you had the largest extinction event, was the Permian Triassic extinction event 250 million years ago. And in Siberia, you had an area the size of Europe. It was called the Siberian Traps, and it was a complex of huge super volcanoes, you know, with dozens of miles. The calderas were dozens of miles across, and it was surrounded by the largest hydrocarbon deposits in the world. And the Siberian Traps blew for something like 10,000 years, and they set fire to all these hydrocarbon deposits and all that stuff. It was the largest fossil fuel furnace in the history of the world. And it killed 90% of these species in the sea and on the land.
I bet.
They died in suffocating heat.
Bob, do we have any idea? We probably don't. The damage that Fukushima has caused, whether any of this contamination has floated over to the West Coast here, and what it could do to us.
They've done studies on people, and they find areas where they think the cancer rates have gone up, and they do spot checks on fish and whatever. But the thing about Fukushima is it's just going to be going on and on and on. It's never going to end. The Chernobyl. As horrible as Chernobyl was, they were able to throw
a dome around it.
Yeah, they put a big dome, and they've had to put another dome over it too. And you can't do that, really, because the Chernobyl was in the middle of a wilderness, and it didn't contaminate that much water. But you can't with Fukushima that it will be constantly. Contaminating water forever.
Now, does a Chernobyl that means Wormwood, or Wormwood that means Chernobyl?
I've never looked that up.
That's something biblical there.
Oh, it should. It's straight out of Revelation.
Get your website out one more time, Bob. Go ahead.
Thank you. www.robertgleasonbooks.com. Gleason is GLEASON. robertgleasonbooks.com, and the title of my novel is And Into the Fire.
You got it. Thank you, Robert. Really appreciate it. Great book, by the way, and I hope it's turned into a TV show or a movie. That would be great. Up next, Finding Magic, a spiritual memoir. Sally Quinn joins us on Coast to Coast AM.